Well, first of all, I'd like to thank all the organizers for giving me this opportunity to present some of the work we have done recently. Actually, the surprises is certainly for me. We'll see whether it's also a surprise for everyone in this audience. So today I would like to talk to you about a RNA protein complex that is also an enzyme. And in this table here, I listed the catalytic RNAs that are known to be in the present-day biology. And I grouped them into two different classes, namely, you know, there are two catalytic RNAs, we call them enzymes. For obvious reasons, the enzymes that can not only bind substrates specifically, it catalyze reaction, but also it carries out multiple turnover reactions in the cell. So ribosome, this is the big news last year, was after the crystal structures, everyone's thinking now was the final proof that the ribosome, in fact, the peptide transferase reaction, or the formation of peptide bonds, ribosome is catalyzed by the ribosome RNA. But as you can see, ribosome is fairly large, so the large subunit, the ribosome has two subunits, the large subunit is the one responsible for this enzymatic reaction. The large subunit has two RNAs with a total size of roughly 3,000 nucleotides, and that's almost 1 million Dalton in molecular weight. And then large subunit ribosome also has roughly 35 proteins, though, with each of those with a 10 to 30 kDa molecular weight. And it can form, the peptide bond formation can happen very quickly, so on average you can make 20 amino acids can be incorporated into a protein per second. So the turnover rate on the ribosome for this ribozyme, so to say, is at least 20 per second. Whereas, most of them are essentially there to allow the ribosome RNA to fold into the correct structure. There are some speculations on the proteins. There are two particular ribosomal proteins in a large subunit that are thought to contribute somewhat to the catalytic activity, but they're more than 30 enzymes away from the actual active site in the ribosome.
So sort of
the RNA. They're not chaperones. They stay bound to the right. So it's part of the machine. Now the other enzyme that's called a ribonuclease P. And it's a lot simpler than a ribosome. So this enzyme has one RNA subunit on the order of 300 to 400 nucleotides. And it has only one protein. It's fairly small. And the KC, that is the rate of chemical catalysis. I'm going to show you, of course, what this ribonuclease P does on the next slide. But the bottom line is you can catalyze reactions fairly rapidly as well for an RNA enzyme. It's on the order of 10 per second. The turnover rate is roughly 1 per second. And then there are six other RNAs, I call these catalytic RNAs. Well, they are catalytic RNAs, but they do not turn over in biology, in the cell. Okay, now these are the two molecules. Those are Nobel Prize winning molecules. In fact, in 1989, the people who discovered that glucagon intron was catalytic, and Sidney Orman discovered that the RNA subunit in RNSP components was catalytic, got them the Nobel Prize in chemistry.
All they do is splice themselves out of the
for these. RNA. For these, yeah. Not for the RNSP, right. Okay, so then what does the RNSP do? This is, of course, the focus of my laboratory. So the RNSP carries out the reaction to produce mature 5' end of all transferring RNAs. Some of you may know, in protein synthesis, there's a ribosome, and there are also two other RNAs, namely messenger RNA and a transferring RNA. Transferring RNAs are the ones that they have an amino acid attached to their 3' end, which is shown over there. Now, but in the cell, though, the transferring RNAs are made in a precursor form. What that means is that they have extra nucleotides attached to both the 5' and 3' ends. So here, what I'm showing you here, the nucleotide attached to the 5' end are shown in red, and the nucleotides attached to the 3' end of a mature transferring RNA, this is the actual crystal structure of a tRNA, is shown in green. So the RNSP is the only enzyme responsible in all the cells to produce mature 5' end of all tRNAs. It does that by binding to this preformed tRNA structure and carries out a site-specific endonucleolytic cleavage reaction. And the 3' is processed by other enzymes. It's not related to the RNSP. Okay, so how many substrates do we know about this? So in E. coli, though, there are four sort of classes of known substrates, four types of known substrates grouped into roughly two classes. So in the so-called class 1 substrates, that includes all the precursors of tRNAs. In E. coli, there are roughly 84, there are 84 tRNA genes in E. coli. And there's another RNA called tmRNA. This is the RNA that does something that deals with, say, a truncated messenger RNA. So in case the messenger RNA is truncated or the ribosome gets stored on some messenger RNA, this RNA then is required to allow the ribosome to have to be sort of relieved from the truncated messenger RNA. And so the class 1 RNA substrates, though, they have basically the tRNA structure. So tmRNA has exactly the same structure as the top portion of the tRNA. And the class 2s, there are two other known RNA substrates. The one RNA is called 4.5S, and this is the RNA that's responsible for signal transduction. What these recognition is used to thread the peptide through a membrane. So again, in E. coli, there is a plasma membrane, and there are a lot of proteins that either needs to be exported into the plasmic space, or they need to be inserted into the membrane. And somewhat, this RNA is responsible to helping these proteins to get exported into the.
No,
84.
Right. About
91 mass. Oh, yeah. Generally, right. You have, generally, the cells have roughly, there are 61 codons, right? In principle, you can have at least, they need at least 35 to 40 tRNAs to allow it to encode it for all 61 codons. Okay, then we have another RNA, which is, this function is not so clear, but it's thought to be an on-site sense regulator, but this was found in a phage. All right, so now, what is the RNSP made of? In bacteria, it has two components, one RNA, roughly 400 nucleotides or 125 kilodaltons or so, and one protein, and that's on the order of 14 kilodaltons. And eukaryotes, we have one RNA of similar size, but many more proteins. To give you an idea, in Saccharomyces cerevisiae, and that's the brewer's yeast, it has 9 proteins. And something like in us, we have one RNA, but we don't even know how many proteins we have. We think we have at least 6 proteins. So for a biochemist, especially for experimental biochemists, the interesting feature of a bacteria, RNSP subunit, is that it is catalytically active in the absence of the protein. So actually, in this instance, we can do some experiments to compare the RNA alone reaction and the reaction catalyzed by the RNA protein complex. Okay, so again, shown here is the secondary structure of the transfer of the RNSP RNA. So from now on, we'll refer to this as the pRNA. And this is the pRNA from this organism, from this bacteria called Bacillus, whatever that is, may become interesting later as a point of discussion. So this pRNA has roughly 400 nucleotides, and its secondary structure is derived from phylogeny. This was done by Norm Pace, and he's now at the University of Colorado. So the secondary structure essentially is done by collecting all the sequences, and then comparing and looking for pairwise co-aerations among all RNSP RNAs, and then so every time there's a co-aeration that obeys the rules of Watson-Crick base pairs, and then these will be grouped into helices, since they have the helices called in P's, which stand for paired elements. So this is helix 1, helix 2, and the numbering always starts from the five prime end and so on. And the pRNA is actually composed of two domains. So this enzyme is literally like more or less like a protein enzyme. A lot of protein enzymes, they have multiple domains. They help them to do different things. So what we found several years ago is that this pRNA has two domains. So this portion, which is roughly 60% of the pRNA, this is a domain we call it catalytic domain because it contains the entire active site of this enzyme, of this ribozyme. And then the top portion, though, because it is a specificity domain. So what happened is this portion binds to the portion of the tRNA and confers specificity. So in fact, what we know now is that this domain binds this area of the tRNA precursor, and then remember the reaction happens here, and then this domain binds to this portion of the tRNA. This confers a specificity for this enzyme reaction. I'm going to tell you a little more about that later. Okay. No. So let me show you a picture very soon to give you an idea how the binding happens. The substrate recognition does not occur through Watson-Crick base pairing. Rather, it's sort of through so-called shape complementarity. It recognizes a folded shape of the tRNA.
What is the role of the MGC
plus? Oh, magnesium. Let's deal with this tomorrow. This is about folding issues. There's no relationship today. Okay. In my laboratory, we study the folding of this tRNA as well, which is going to be the subject of my talk tomorrow. Okay, so today I'm going to tell you four things. Four topics. I'm going to tell you something about the proposed functions for this bacterial RSV protein. The first proposed function was proposed back in 88, and until 99, we thought we have all the functions sorted out. Of course, the hint surprise, in the year 2000, we found something we thought it got more interesting. And then I'm going to tell you something about three-prime substrate determinants and allelic processing. This gives us some ideas about this domain organization or functional partition of this RNA protein enzyme. And the surprise, at least as far as I'm concerned, was we found in last year primarily by doing smart angle X-ray scattering that RSV holoenzyme contains holoenzyme is the RNA protein complex. Just the nomenclature is called a holoenzyme. It actually contains two RSV RNA and two RSV protein subunits. In fact, for 20 years, we thought this enzyme is composed of one protein, one RNA subunit. And then that allowed us, or at least has inspired us, to ask the following question: how does RSV really work in the cell? Okay, I'm just going to tell you function of the protein, what we know this until year 99. So Norm Pace in 88 proposed the following functions of the protein. So in this diagram, we do not have a crystal structure of this RNA at all. And even so, the RNA can be crystallized and diffracts to something like 4 angstroms of 3.5 angstrom resolution, but it has been very difficult to obtain a crystal structure. We do have a crystal structure of this RSV protein by itself, which is shown over here. Tell you a little bit about that crystal structure in a moment. As far as functions concerned, back in 88, this diagram, Pace's model, was that this is the pRNA portion, and this is the tRNA portion. So this is the enzyme, this is the substrate. And then, so the protein is thought to be this positively charged blob. So, right, what we have here is we have a negatively charged enzyme, which is an RNA. We have a negatively charged RNA, enzyme. We have a negatively charged RNA substrate, and we have a positively charged protein. So he said, okay, well, the possibility then is this enzyme is sitting here. So what happened is if we take the enzyme away, the RNA alone reaction works poorly. But if you add a lot of salt, so, go to 1 molar, instead of sitting at 100 millimolars, say, KCl, potassium chloride, we go to 1 molar potassium chloride. And instead of sitting at, say, 5 millimolar magnesium chloride, we go to 100 millimolar magnesium chloride. So we can get this reaction to go pretty well. So in this proposal, he thought that the primary function of the RNA of the protein is to help the product to be released under physiological conditions. Because of the high salt conditions, the product would like to stick to this RNA. They're both negative charged, high salt, positive charge. The protein somehow figured out a way to allow this dissociation to happen a little bit faster. That turned out to be not quite correct. So in 88, Carl Ferkey's lab proposed a different function. Oh, as far as I'm concerned, maybe it wasn't that dramatic, but it was much more clear. So also in the same year, Ferkey's lab they solved the crystal structure of the T protein. This is the crystal structure of the T protein. It looks like a ribosomal protein. That means it looks like a generic RNA binding protein. But just gazing at the protein structure alone, Ferkey's lab saw this protein appears to have three different RNA binding sites. This is just a proposal, though. But through some careful experiments, they mapped one of the three binding sites, which is composed of this four-stranded beta sheet here, combine to a region of a, in a single of the, combine a single-stranded RNA. Okay, so now, so the proposal here then is the P protein promotes substrate binding by directly contacting the 5' promoter. In fact, she has very nice data to show that. So what I'm showing you here is, so this portion is the tRNA portion. And remember, the substrate is really tRNA plus some nucleotides, unstructured nucleotides, 5'2N, and that is called a 5' liter. So substrate is then 3' tRNA, 5' liter. And then the protein actually has a contact site that, that directly binds to 5' liter of the substrate. So this helps the substrate binding tremendously. So Furkey lab determined that K-heterokm in the presence of protein compared to the K-heterokm in the absence of protein is roughly factor 10,000. This is done under physiological conditions. But the 5' liter binding accounts for a factor 1,000. So this, I would say that this property of the P protein alone will account to, you know, three orders out of four orders of magnitude for this function, for the function of the protein. Okay. By the way, in the presence to the K-heterokm plus, that means the K-heterokm of the RNA protein complex is near diffusion limit. So this is one of those enzymes that works very well, you know, so-called a perfect enzyme. Okay, so what did we do? So we proposed two other functions of this protein. And in 88, we said, okay, we think that the presence of the protein alters the substrate recognition. This goes back to how does this enzyme recognize the substrate. I'm showing you here is a portion of the tRNA substrate. This corresponds to the portion back. How do I go back? Okay, so this corresponds to that portion corresponds to this area of the tRNA, and this area is contacted by this domain in this ribosome. Okay, so what we have determined through some biochemical tricks and things like that, what we have determined are the functional groups, primarily 2'-hydroxyl groups, at these positions that make direct contacts to the enzyme. Now, in the absence of the protein, it turned out the contact size has in this area has five functional groups that make direct contacts, and that's shown in all three red and the two green. So then, in the presence of the protein, however, the contact size has shrunk by so these two are no longer contacted, and also only these three are contacted. So think of this way: in the absence of the protein, the contact surface is this big; in the presence of the protein, the contact surface is only this big. Now that initially was a little bit counterintuitive because we thought, of course, you're adding stuff to the enzyme, you should get more specificity. But this result told us, no, it's the opposite. So in fact, if we start with the RNA alone reaction, add protein, we get less specificity because now we can, this enzyme can go on and work with substrates which doesn't have to have the same kind of structure as a tRNA, which makes, again, biological sense because biologically there are two classes of substrates. This result somewhat rationalized why this holo enzyme can, this RNA protein complex works really well with both classes of substrates as it evolved to do. But if you take the protein away, the RNA alone reaction works only with the class one substrate, and that's the tRNA and then tmRNA, but now it's the class two substrate. Okay, so then a year later, we proposed a second function for this protein, which we thought account for the remainder factor 10, for the difference in the K-heterokm in the plus-minus protein reaction. So what I'm showing you here is as follows. So we know there's very little domain-domain interaction in the RNA. We also know that the protein, through footprinting studies, I'm going to show you a little bit, that the protein contacts both domains. This is all in the absence of substrate. So we thought then, so in the absence of the protein, these domains, let's say, is oriented, let's say, this way. Now, this will bind to the tRNA, all right, but this is not a catalytically active conformation. What he wants to do is the domains wants to be this way. Okay. So that's shown over here. So what we have is in the presence of the protein, these domains are oriented this way. But take the protein away, this domain gets, you know, shifted over there. This will bind to substrate, but that's not the right conformation. This undergoes a conformational change and goes down to here. Now what we have now then is the equilibrium between two ES complexes. Now that equilibrium constant goes into the chemical state we measure as a function of K equilibrium, K eq divided by 1 plus K eq. Now we know this equilibrium constant, which was estimated to be 0.1. So we got 0.1 divided by 1.1 is 0.1. But in the presence of the protein for this reaction, the protein already pre-oriented, pre-oriented domains already. So what we have now then is this conformational change in the presence of complex of the substrate is favorable. So we can estimate the K equilibrium constant for this transition is 40. So we take 40 divided by 41, that's 1. So that's the difference in factor 10. So we're quite happy. We say, okay, so what's there left to do? By the year 99, I said, okay, well, we just wait for crystal structure to happen. But at that time, we're doing some small angle X-ray scattering work at Argonne National Lab for folding studies. And so I said, okay, well, we might as well take these samples along with us. We go in and measure this conformational switch, perhaps by scattering. We can do some modeling and so on. Okay, so before I get in there, I want to tell you something. So that was my first topic. Now, the second topic here is just to tell you a little bit more about what happened when you have this protein. So what I'm showing you here, again, this looks like a very busy slide, but I just want you to look at the residues that are shaded. What I'm trying to show here is, so this is the pRNA, and the box residues are the ones that we take the pRNA, which is made by in the test tube, and then we purify these RNAs in the denatured form. Then we have this RNA sitting there in water. So then if we take that RNA sitting in water and bombard it with hydroxy radical, so what happened then is hydroxy radical would just react with the backbone of the RNA and will cut the backbone everywhere. But if we add a magnesium to this, in a different test tube, and that generally allows the RNA to fold up. And when the RNA is filled up, then there will be backbone positions that are less accessible to the solvent. Okay, so that gives us so-called a hydroxy radical footprint, right? And the box residues are the ones that when we add magnesium, these are get protected against hydroxy radical attack. This suggesting this is how this thing fold up. But so then this is all done in absence of protein. In fact, the RNA folds beautifully under physiological conditions, no problem whatsoever. Because I have magnesium folds. It doesn't need a protein to fold at all. Because we can titrate the magnesium as a function of activity. So then, then we add a protein. So then protein will give us additional footprints. So those footprints are shown as a shaded residue. You can see this, there are sort of a large number of shaded residues. We have, I grouped them roughly into four areas, 1, 2, 3, 4. It's actually, the protein is a 14 kilodalton protein. The footprint is really large. So it's something additional is happening. We also did the same kind of experiment, just with this catalytic domain alone. All right, so we take this domain alone, get rid of the domain on top. Repeat this experiment, we get the folding just fine, the added protein. What we see is that actually we get, I label these regions A, B, C. There's a region X, which would be corresponding to the region 3. So, and all this is gone. And what we have here is, I think the A and C, that probably correspond to this region number 4 over here. Remember, this is not a precise science. These are things done mostly only semi-quantitative fashion. So we only talk about regions that are protected, not really residues, specific residues. They don't have to match. They rarely match anyway. Okay, so then this region, unfortunately, we could not see here because of our experimental limitation. So what I think then is if you compare these two footprinting patterns, I would say, this seems to be around here will be a direct contact site of the protein. Now, over here, this is gone in the absence of this domain on top. So this is probably probably not a direct protein contact. I'm not so sure. Or this may be due to some interactions that happens, let's say RNA contact that happens in the presence of the protein. So we can think, all right, perhaps in this case, we have two direct contact regions for the protein, one here, and then when this protein binds, these domains get brought together, and these two sort of get together, somehow protect each other. That's sort of the idea that we can get from this kind of experiment. And that guess, of course, was wrong. Later on, once we know this is a dimer, I don't even know what to attribute to what.
The capital letters are highly conserved,
base
pairs, and the small ones.
Oh, no, no. Okay. No, these are just, sorry. No, no, no. The capital letters are the ones that we can, those are positions we can detect experimentally. That's the lowercase are ones we cannot detect experimentally. That's really what this means here in this graph. Okay, so, but nevertheless, we know this is active for, this is a catalytically active for many reasons. So we decided to just do some activity assays comparing these two different versions of this enzyme in the presence of the protein. So what we have here is we have this molecule, we call this full length, wild type, whatever. And then we have this one, we call this catalytic domain. Okay. So now, before I go on, I just want to give you one more piece of information. This is called the 5' substrate determinants. So what does that mean? If I go to over here, so this is our, say, tRNA substrate. And this portion of the tRNA, which is shown in the uppercase letters, and the lowercase letters is called a 5' leader, and there is the reaction site over here. So this is the phosphodiester bond that will be hydrolyzed. Okay, so the Ferkey lab then did as we call a 5' truncation. So the 5' region is unstructured, so they can just truncate starting from something like 5 nucleotides. It turned out you can have any activity. Adding additional nucleotides past 5, it doesn't really make any much difference at all. So you start from 5 nucleotides and cut one nucleotide, cut one off at a time. And then just take the full-length pRNA protein complex and then just do this experiment. Okay, so this is what they got. So what we're looking at here is if you take the holoenzyme or the RNA protein complex, what I'm just trying to compare is this is the KC cleavage. This is for the chemical step for the actual catalysis reaction. So at 5, this is a delta-delta G value. So we cut 5 off, this has no effect. You can really cut up to, you know, 2 nucleotides. So all this enzyme needs 2 nucleotides in the 5' leader region for almost full activity in the catalysis. But it's a little bit different for binding, so this is called this binding. So if you have 5 nucleotides, it binds really well. We cut this one off, we get, it loses roughly 2 kcals per mole. This corresponds to about 30-fold or so. And up until this over here, and then cut this one off is really bad. Loses another 40-fold or so. Okay, so now if you this result is very consistent with what Ferkey found before, that in fact remember I told you the protein has a 5' leader binding site which contacts roughly this portion of the substrate, so that sort of makes at least some correlation there. I just ignore that one. Okay, now what we want to do is we want to determine the 3' substrate, make a 3' substrate determinant, because now the 3' portion is the tRNA. So there we cannot just keep truncating, and it's not very useful. So we designed this set of experiments. So we said, okay, the tRNA substrate will be the most complicated one. That's the ones that has the most structure. So we can sort of gradually decrease the structural complexity of the substrates. So what we have here is we have these hairpin loops. I said, okay, these substrates will correspond to roughly this portion of the RNA structure here, and then we keep going back. By the time we're down here, we are back to the single-stranded region. So we have these substrates that can give us progressive ideas of what is really needed for the 3' for the tRNA portion. But in this case, we're comparing the reactions of the holoenzyme versus the complex that's formed between just the C domain and the P protein. So if I go back again, so the C domain, remember, is the ones that actually we know already before we did this experiment, it binds to this portion of the substrate. Okay. So now if we go back to here, these are delta-delta G numbers. I guess something got knocked out. T22 is probably not an element, it's not an isotope. So what we're measuring here, again, we measure the catalysis rate between from ES to EP, and that's shown here. But again, what I'm comparing here is the whole enzyme versus the protein reaction. So we can start with over here. So negative means better. So if you take a single strand of the RNA, but with a single nucleotide in the 3' portion, that's our baseline. Then we add a few more nucleotides to the single strand region, we get really a large increase over here. This is, but if you go back, compared to the binding step, call this the binding, if you add three nucleotides, you know, two nucleotides to that, we really see a very little improvement in binding, but a large improvement in catalysis, and this is very consistent with this enzyme mechanism called substrate destabilization. So when you bind substrate, some of the binding energy then is used to strain the bonds that the enzyme wants to hydrolyze, and that will improve the catalysis step, but all the binding energy is sort of used in that regard. Then if we keep adding structures, we keep getting this kind of stuff, and you keep increasing, but by the time here, by the time we add a tRNA, this is the final step of addition. But the one thing that's interesting for us, at least, is that up until this point, if we go to the hairpin loop, right, so if we don't add the portion of tRNA that we know interact with the other domain which we deleted in the C-domain P-protein complex, if we don't add that portion, and actually there's very little difference between the holoenzyme reaction, between the holoenzyme reaction versus the C-domain and the P-protein complex reaction. So that suggests to us, this is something else, okay. So that suggests to us, at least, this enzyme is really a completely modular, it's a complete modular enzyme. So what that is that it has three parts. You have a catalytic domain, which has the active site, and that's all you got. And then it has a specificity domain. That's a domain that binds to the portion that that portion is present, and you will interact with that and has some effect. And then we have the protein. The protein actually is the part that is used to make some direct contacts to the 5' leader portion. So what we have is this is sort of an enzyme, the RNA protein enzyme that's made of three parts. You have, you can throw these things around really. So in fact, what we can do in my lab is that we can take that specificity domain and substitute that with something else. And we get a perfectly matching a new enzymes out, and those new enzymes will have a perfectly matching structure to whatever this replacement we put in that in the same place at the place of the specificity domain. So it works out very well. The protein actually decreases specificity. It doesn't add any. It adds affinity, of course, because it binds single strand region. Okay. All right. So then the other thing we found was that this is probably not that interesting. Let me move on to something interesting. Okay. So that was my end of my topic number two. This is my third topic, and this is when we found out this was a dimer. So this may be familiar to some of you, this audience. So this is a small X-ray scattering experiment. So we did that at the Advanced Photon Source at the Argonne National Lab. So here, a postdoc in the lab designed a flow cell that allowed us to do all these things in a very convenient fashion. And so what we're looking at here is we take a tRNA. This is our standard for the sizing. So we have tRNA scattering over here, and it has you can see the radio generation of 24 angstroms, which is completely, you can calculate the scattering curve of P of R functions and the RG from the crystal structure, it comes out exactly that. Okay, then if we take the pRNA, and this one goes up here, this RG of 47, but the pRNA, though, has a molecular weight that's roughly 4 or 5 times bigger, so that corresponds to the I0 value also very nicely. So when we added the P protein, at least to my surprise, it forms a dimer. And so that's a red curve. And the I0 exactly doubles, and then we get this kind of a P of R function.
So had it not formed a dimer,
yes, okay, let me show you over here. So what happened here is if you take the pRNA by itself, just change the ionic condition. So here we have 10 millimolar magnesium by itself, and then we added 0.9 molar monovalent iron. So we know the monovalent iron actually has an effect on the catalytic activity of the RNA alone reaction, but it has no effect on the whole enzyme reaction. So we can see the difference in fact, we can, very different energies and so on. And the pre-protein by itself is a monomer. We know that for quite some time. So meaning this is a sort of a protein-promoted RNA dimerization or things like that. Okay. So now that was now you know I'm by training I'm a biochemist. And I said, well, small molecular scattering, some you know, it's pretty tough for me. Or if I need to explain this to some molecular biologist, you know, they'll have trouble understanding what I'm saying. So we devised this experiment for molecular biologists. So I call this an affinity retention. So how does that work? So we take two different tRNAs. So one tRNA, the pRNA in one tube is bioattenulated. It has a biotin covalently attached to the RNA. And the pRNA in the other tube is labeled with reactivity. So it's radioactive pRNA. So we make these RNAs, and then we add the protein. Okay, so after we add the protein, we bind, then just take the whole mixture and put it on an avidine bead, right? So then what happened then is only if this RNA protein is an oligomer, it will get pulled down. The reactive pRNA will only get pulled down because it oligomerizes. And if you present the protein, wash it, and then we elute it with just adding EDTA that would just chelate all the magnesium, unfolds the RNA, the whole thing would come off. The reactive pRNA will come out. And now, to do it quantitatively, we just vary the ratio of these two. So what we have here is we have the total concentration of these two RNAs always constant, shown here. The total remains constant. And we add equal molar of a P protein as well. Then we vary the ratio. We start from, well, we can't get a point with no P32. We start with P32 as 0.1, it goes all the way to 1, and we collect this data point. And along the ratio, this is what we get come out. This is just the actual gel. And what's come out is like this, and this can be fit to a curve, assuming a dimer ratio. And you can see the fit is quite nice. But if we use a different pRNA, which I'm going to show you next one, so here instead, So here we still take the pRNA that is bioattenulated. This is pRNA again from the organism Bacillus. Now we mix with the pRNA from an organism that's from E. coli. That's called M1, just for nomenclature reasons. So now we have a mixed bag. We have two different RNAs, but now we radioactively label the M1 RNA, and we still use the Bacillus, the bioattenulated Bacillus RNA. We get a different result. Now this is the gel. You can see it doesn't quite look like a bell-shaped curve. And then if we go back to take the raw data and plot it, and we, instead of seeing a bell-shaped curve like this, which would be this one here, we get something like that. Okay. Then we can play with some equations that we can come down here. So we take that equation and modify it a little bit. So if it's a dimer, then this is the Bacillus data. We should get a line. If it's an aggregate, we should get something like this weird thing. And in fact, we can say model as follows. So if it's a dimer looks like this, an aggregate, in this case, we have pRNA, we have the M1, and it forms a sort of a mixture of aggregates. So this is a dimer, but it seems to be a quite specific dimer. Okay, then, you know, with the SACS data on hand, we can actually do some modeling. Remember, we say there's no crystal structure, but there are models of pRNA. The models are rough. That's all we have. Okay, so we can take the models, this is model it. And this looks very busy, but ignore that thing, because what I'm showing you here is this is a modeling that's done with these domain orientation changes. Remember I mentioned at the beginning that these two domains in absent protein, these things move around. So if you have the P protein without the protein, just the RNA alone, so in this case we have three models, and they all have the same C domain, so we put the C domain on top. And this is the other domain, S domain. And the shown here, this is the original model. This model doesn't really fit to any of our data, the SACS data. So all we did was somehow, you know, rotated this domain so instead of going 30 degrees this way, we do a 60 degrees and we do a 90 degrees. This corresponds to the pRNA scattering without the monovalent salt, and this will correspond to the one with monovalent salt. and it sort of got much closer to our experimental data. But so this is the pRNA by itself. Then to get to the dimer, we don't know where to put the protein, but luckily the protein is only 1/10 of the molecular weight of the RNA, and also the protein scatters 5 times weaker than the RNA. So essentially all the scattering more or less came from the RNA. So we have a very symmetrical dimer here, and then I think the red is the experimental, and then the purple is the calculated curve. Since this is a model on a model, I thought this was quite good. In fact, the radial gyration for the experimentally determined species was 57 angstroms, for the model was 56, and that was quite close. Okay, so we think this is how this thing looks like. Now, why bother to have a dimer? After all, so let's get us start thinking. So,
you know what the stoichiometry of the protein is also?
It's 1:1.
1:1.
Yeah. We did a titration and so on. Yeah, it's always 1:1. Okay, so first thing. Okay, now we know the physical state of this thing is a dimer. Now, we said, okay, what's the reason for this to be a dimer? And just to add a little twist to this, and we did some experiments with the E. coli enzyme as well. Now, E. coli enzyme, it was much harder to work with because the protein is not well behaved. But nevertheless, we got some results, and we thought that actually the E. coli enzyme is a monomer. So in fact, in this case, we have sort of a divergence here among microbes. So if you take the E. coli version, that's a monomer, meaning one RNA, one protein. And if you take the Bacillus version, it's a dimer. And it's two RNA, two proteins. So if there's something special about these tRNA genes in these two organisms. So now both E. coli and Bacillus genome has been sequenced. And Bacillus been sequenced in 97, E. coli, I think, was 98. And so now we can go in and just check all these tRNAs out. Okay, so this is what we found. Showing you here, this is the Bacillus tRNA organization. Now it has, so what I'm showing you here is the number of tRNA in the transcript. So this is the transcript is the RNA that's made. And then how often it happens. And okay, so first focus on these two columns. So you can see in Bacillus there's some tRNAs that appear once or twice in the transcript. But there are a lot of tRNAs that appear in a much larger tRNAs, we call it a gene cluster. And for example, there are larger ones that goes 16 tRNAs in the one transcript or 21 tRNAs in one transcript. Oh, I'm going to show you what tRNA they are on the next one slide. The E. coli, however, is much less prominent. So we have mostly the tRNA in transcripts ones and twos, some clusters, but they're really not a lot compared to that. But more interestingly, in Bacillus, there are clusters are called ribosome RNA associated. So what are these things? You can't see from here anyway. All right, fine. These five clusters have no promoters on their own. That means there's no, you cannot make these tRNAs just by making it transcribing it from DNA. You have to start elsewhere. Now, the elsewhere is the ribosomal RNAs. And all the ribosomal RNAs are organized in this bacteria in always the same way. It has three ribosomal RNAs. It always goes, we call it 16S, 23S, and 5S. Okay. So these five clusters then are associated with this ribosomal RNA cluster. So in order to make these tRNAs, you got to make the ribosomal RNA. But also, the 5' prime or the upstream of all these tRNAs is this one specific ribosomal RNA they call the 5S. Okay. And then E. coli, there's no such a thing. You can see that, E. coli associated is not, doesn't have this kind of a special feature. Okay, so then this is the organization I was telling you about. Just give you an idea, this is a cluster with 6 tRNAs in them, and then it starts from over here. 16S has 1,800 nucleotides, 23S has 2,900, 5S has 120, and each tRNA has roughly 75. So this is a big monster transcript he has to make. But what kind of tRNAs do these ribosomal RNA, 5S ribosomal RNA associated tRNAs encode? In fact, the 60% of tRNAs, they encode for all 20 amino acids, meaning this kind, whatever this gene organization is making these tRNAs essential for life. You got to have all these, otherwise there's not enough tRNAs, because if you look at the other non-ribosome RNA-associated tRNA clusters, there are only 16 amino acids. It's not enough to make the cell live.
So this is a whole big, very big off-run with the
RNA. Right, there are five of them, right? So I'm showing you just the one with six, but there are ones with, there's a shot with 21, yeah. Right. You take all these together, there are 54 total tRNAs, and we'll get, you'll have all 20 amino acids in them. By RNSP, presumably. So why bothers have a dimer? So we said, oh, maybe perhaps it has something to do with, say, cooperativity, processivity. So processivity is a concept in biology that means once you start something, you got to continue. Once an enzyme, a processive enzyme, when it starts to do something, he has to continue to finish his job on the same substrate or same template before it dissociates. That's what processivity means. So I guess no one ever thought this enzyme would be called processive, but it appears to me, well, at least I have this model here. So in this model, we have so the 5S ribosome RNA is shown in circle, and another tRNA is shown in boxes. And so the tRNA we say is a dimer. This is the bacillus version. And so we think that the 5S RNA is some sort of a landing pad for this enzyme to be loaded on. When it's loaded on, and it will bind to that, it will bind to one first tRNA. Now it carries out a reaction that just cut all this off, and it's down to here. And then that this portion now is then can go back and bind to this this tRNA, and this goes on. This is sort of a processive motion. Once you have these gene clusters in a row, then this thing can just go on and it turns around and sort of rolls over, binds tRNA, cut it, rolls to them, binds the next one, cut it, without ever dissociating from these tRNA, big tRNA transcripts, because a dimer has really two binding sites, which we actually know. We do know the dimer has two tRNA binding sites. We measure that. Yeah, so how do we check that? We are checking it, but it's turned out to be a pretty difficult task. So. No, let me show you the next one. That's what we're doing next. Okay, so here's a question we're interested in now. So we want to know, does 5S ribosome RNA play a functional role in ribosome RNSP processing? This is whether that will be a landing pad. We have results. We know this enzyme actually binds to 5S ribosome RNA specifically, but we don't know what it means functionally. Is the RNSP processing possessive? This is also can be done in vitro. So we actually made that substrate with 16 tRNAs in them. Now the enzymology is pretty complicated because as you can imagine, before we were working with one dinky little one tRNA with one reaction site. Now we have six reaction sites, and we can have a mess. And so recently it occurred to us, single molecule is the way to go. So, I have a collaborator we're working on this. I hope maybe this can give us some ideas whether that works or not. So we do not have an answer. We don't know. In the meantime, I also start to think, okay, well, you might as well do something in vivo, because now after genome projects, a lot of things are much easier to do. So we said, okay, let me go in and do some bacillus genetics. So we're doing that as well. Okay. And that's it. So then I just acknowledge people. The other enzymology was done by a research associate in the lab, Andrew Luria. Small angle scattering and affinity retention was done by another by postdoc, Xing Wan. You're going to see Xing Wan a lot tomorrow. And actually, I did some pipetting there myself. And then collaborators have been doing a lot of work with Tobin Sosnick and protein, also work on protein folding in my department. Xiao Jing did all the modeling of the dimer. And then we're doing, at Argonne, we're collaborating. We have long-term collaboration with Tiaga. And then some of these were done in collaborative effort with Carl Furke, University of Michigan. I guess I'll stop here and thank you for your attention.